translation. Excuse me. O trustworthy Brahmanas, I now ask you about my immediate duty. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances, and specifically of those who are just about to die. Srila Prabhupada's report. In this verse, the king has placed two questions before the learned sages. The first question is, what is the duty of everyone in all circumstances? And the second question is, what is the specific duty of one who is to die very shortly? Out of the two, the question relating to the dying man is most important, because everyone is a dying man, either very shortly or after 100 years. The duration of life is immaterial, but the duty of a dying man is very important. Maharaj Parikshit placed these two questions before Shukadev Goswami also on his arrival, and practically the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the second canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these two questions. The conclusion arrived at thereof is that devotional service of the Lord Sri Krishna, as it is confirmed by the Lord himself in the last phases of the Bhagavad Gita, is the last word in relation to everyone's permanent duty in life. Maharaj Parikshit was already aware of this fact, but he wanted the great sages assembled there to unanimously give their verdict on his conviction, so that he might be able to go on with his confirmed duty without controversy. He had especially mentioned the word shuddha, or perfectly correct, for transcendental realization or self-realization. Many processes are recommended by the various classes of philosophers. Some of them are first-class methods, and some of them are second- or third-class methods. The first-class method demands that one give up all other methods and surrender to the lotus feet of the Lord, and thus be saved from all sins and their reactions. Tatascava prityam imam vipritche visharabhya vipra iti kriyatayam sarvatmana mriyamanaischa krityam shuddham tatatram rishitadiyuktaha. O trustworthy Brahmanas, I now ask you about my immediate duty. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances, and specifically of those who are just about to die. So this is a very important verse, because as Prabhupada says and points out in the purport, did we notice that the whole of Srimad Bhagavatam is actually generated by these two questions? The whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the second canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these two questions. And again, the question, when Shukadeva Goswami appears, he again asks the exact same question to him. So to the sages in general, then when Shukadeva Goswami appeared, they deferred to him, and then Maharaj Parikshit again placed the same question. Now, this verse begins, tata, as such, that is, he's before these sages, and he said, you are the Word made flesh, basically. in the last verse. Veda yatha murti daras. The word, you know this phrase, the word was made flesh. I guess a good topic for Christmas, huh? This is from the Gospel of St. John, which describes the advent of Jesus. And in the beginning was the Word. How does it? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Right? In the beginning, in the beginning, the Greek is arche, in arche heno logos. Arche means in the origin. I mean, arche is a word you could use to mean the absolute truth, in arche, that which is the origin of everything. And logos, these are all terms from Greek philosophy. So what is the Word? What is the eternal Word that's always with God and is none different from God? Well, it's the Veda. Because you say Veda means knowledge, but the word logos means not only, it means speech, it means reason, it means knowledge. All those things are there in the Greek term logos. Like our word logic comes from logos. So that's the Word. And Murti Dara, the Word personified. These people who came, these sages before him, you are like the Word personified. Or you could say the Word made flesh. And that's why, of course, Prabhupada, because of this term, Veda Yata Murti Dara, he mentions, and they're compared to those who come from Satyaloka. So again, as we mentioned, Prabhupada relates Jesus to this place. So here he has got, anyway, here these people are before him. So now you're the perfect people to ask this question. But the really significant thing that we should understand is this is the question. This is the right question. People are going through their lives and they're asking questions because they think they need to know the answer. Now, is it better to invest my money in mutual funds or bonds? You know, you know, if you like me and you're in the riding in the car, you put on the news radio and there's many shows where they have these, you know, experts come on this subject and people call up and ask them the questions, you know. So they have a psychologist and they ask the questions, or they have the investors and they ask the questions. So people are asking many, many questions which concern them, but this is the question, and it is practically the question no one asks these days. Well, as it says here, there's two questions. They're nested one inside the other. What is the kritiyam shuddham, the most perfect thing to be done, the best thing, shuddham, you know, the most perfect, the purest, the highest, the perfectly correct, Prabhupada calls it here. What is the most perfectly correct thing to be done by people in general, but especially those who are about to die? Mriyamanai, especially those who are about to die. This recalled those of us who had Latin many, many years ago when they used to teach it in high school. One of the first Latin phrases we learned was that which was spoken by the gladiators in Rome. What was the phrase? You remember it in Latin? Mortui te salutamus, I think, something like that. Huh? Morturi? We who are about to die salute you. The gladiator, you know, because in Rome, instead of having football games, they had what people really want. Guys in there with weapons and swords killing each other as a spectator sport. The gladiators. So this was So that's what the gladiator, we who are about to die, salute you, they would say to the people in the stands, the cheering fans, and then they would set to it. So what is the special duty of those who are about to die? Here, of course, we're not talking about a gladiator, but we're talking about a king who now he has the notification of death. So now, the first question Prabhupada says, what is the duty of everyone in all circumstances? And then specifically, what is the duty of one who is to die very shortly? But then Prabhupada collapses them into a single question. Out of the two, the question relating to the dying man is most important, because everyone is a dying man. Right. So what's the difference? The duty of everyone in general or those who are about to die? Well, everyone is a dying man. Either very shortly or after 100 years. The duration of life is immaterial. In other words, it doesn't matter. Very shortly can be tomorrow or it could be 100 years from now. But that part is actually of no significance. But the duty of a dying man is very important. So that's the question. And when he places this question again to Shukadeva Goswami, he'll say the two duties are the same. The duty of a dying man is the duty of the universal duty of everyone. It's the same. But the main thing is to remember is that we are all dying people. As soon as you're born, the dying begins. Even before you're born, actually, it begins. Even that's a threatened situation in the womb. Hardly a safe place anymore. So the dying begins. And so this is what people have to remember. Everyone is a dying man. Prabhupada has said that sometimes people want to put off this kind of consideration until, well, wait till I'm old. And then Prabhupada said, old age means just before you die. So is there anyone who can say that they are not old? So therefore we have to all consider ourselves on the brink of death. We are standing with one foot in the grave. People used to commonly talk about this. There's old hymns and old things like that. You listen to Bach cantatas, there's so many hymns that are set to music, I'm standing with one foot in the grave, and so on like that, and I have no security, and any minute I'm going to plunge into this pit, and so on like that. People used to be a little more conscious of this, and it was considered a topic for meditation. There's a famous carvings in the Cemetery of Innocents in Paris in the Middle Ages, called the Dance of Death, Danse Macabre, which shows, depicts various people getting married and a king being coronated, and so all these ceremonial moments. And in the procession, there's always these skeletons banging on drums and so on. Everyone, you're going through the pomp and glory of life and everything, but you're always being accompanied by every minute by death, who's always personified as a skeleton jumping up and down and reaping their harvest as they go. So people used to be more conscious of this. And actually what happens is as spiritual knowledge fades, so also does this awareness fade. In other words, the illusion goes thicker, and the illusion is the illusion of security. Because our position in the material world is radically insecure. And of course, people are always trying to become secure. They want to know that they're in a position that's safe. They want security, they want safety, they want shelter. And it's simply not available in the material world. On one of these car radio news programs, there was an interview that I listened to. There was an interview with some entrepreneur who had made a fortune, lost it, and actually spent 6 months as a street person in New York City, and then again made another fortune. and so he was being interviewed, and he said, actually, everyone is just a step away from being homeless, he said. That was his realization. And it's quite true. I think you could take anyone who's got all kinds of security, and if you asked them to start thinking about it, they could imagine very quickly what would have to happen to put them on the streets, even though you have so many arrangements. So that won't happen. What to speak of dying? So people are very much in the state of insecurity, and they don't like to think about it. And it takes like the shock of this millionaire who ended up on the street person to realize that actually we're all just a few steps away from losing everything. So if people knew this, then most of what is called civilization would disappear, because most of civilization is a kind of systematic hypnosis to keep people thinking, I'm secure, I'm safe, I have prospects in front of me. And the reason they can't think about this is because they've invested their energy what they're looking for is salvation. Everybody wants salvation. They want to be saved. But when you say you want security, right, what does that mean? Now think of what secure means. You want a position in which there's no birth, no death, no old age, and no disease. Really? How much security do you want? Well, I mean, what people are... the things that people do from security, I mean, you can start with the electronic equipment to guard your house. You can start with financial security. You can talk with insurance. You can talk about the system of medical care. So what are these things, all the security to guard you against? Well, it's to guard you against death, mostly. And disease, old age, security in your old age, right? How many people want, that's the big thing, what's going to happen when I get old? So that's what people want to be. They want to be secure. They want a position that is actually the position of the spirit soul. That's why we want it. It is our position. It's our constitutional position. But they want the constitutional of the spirit soul without actually acting on the spiritual planet platform. They want it in the material world. They want to transfer to the material body those things which belong to the soul. So people want to preserve and protect their material body so it goes on forever in happiness and ever-increasing bliss, right? Won't work. It won't work. It's a bad investment. all these advisors are telling, nobody, but none of these advisors, none of these experts on various forms of security tell people this, hey, there's no security. Forget it. Yeah. They actually call them securities, don't they? I mean, these are financial instruments that people, various sorts of securities. Well, they're not. And if you do listen to the news, most of it is an obsessive worry and report of collapses of systems of security. Right now, a big chunk of Asia is in economic freefall. The giants that people thought were like the pace setters, Japan, Korea, you know, their strong financial institutes, their banks, are failing. And the ripple effect is going to even affect, or it's going to affect the whole rest of the world. They fail, you know. Planes fall out of the sky, you know, everybody kind of obsess about that. You know, why did it happen and so on. This is just a form of worrying about death. All these ways are worrying about death. And of course, you know, they make this recommendation and that recommendation and so on. But there's no, this is worry without any real result, because the thing is that all these systems, they will fail. The things that one takes shelter of in the material world to protect one against death are called by Srimad Bhagavatam fallible soldiers. One is invested in these fallible soldiers. Prabhupada has pointed out, it's very, very, very cool what Prabhupada said. He said, people have declared war on material nature, and it is a war they are certain to lose. So anybody who wants to enjoy in the material world, is basically what you have to say. You have to stop time. You have to stop material nature. Then you can be happy. So what you've done is declared war on material nature. Now who's going to win? It's not going to happen. So one has to look at the situation with a cool eye. And say, yeah, that's true. It won't work. But people can't afford to do that, because they have invested everything, all their hopes, precisely in this false account, and they don't want to hear the truth. So they have their systematic systems of delusion, which is called civilization. Mostly that's what's being propagated. Some little ways that you can think that somehow or other everything is going to be all right, even though you're on the brink of collapse. Everyone's system is on the brink of collapse, but somehow or other they're going to ignore it. Now, the need for security is necessary, because we are eternal beings. There's nothing wrong with the need. There are people like existentialists, part of the existentialist philosophy, which claim to look at this stuff, look at life without any delusions whatsoever, and just live with that radical insecurity. But they don't. Ultimately, they all end up making up systems of illusion anyway, such as the system of illusion: I'm living with radical insecurity. I'm important. I'm braver than everybody else. Or I'm a great philosopher. I knew one person who described the situation that I'm talking about, he invented the term existential mistrust. Okay, so we call it, what's existential mistrust. So now he took a situation and gave it an important name and wrote many books about it. That's his system. Existential Mistrust and the Death of God, his book was called. One actually needs to have some real security. Otherwise, if you really become free from all illusions, then you would actually be insane. Just like what happens to soldiers who spend too long a time in combat. They all become psychological casualties. If they're not physical casualties, they're psychological casualties. Now we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. It used to be called combat fatigue in World War II, and in World War I it was called shell shock. These people, soldiers who had spent too long in combat and had just fallen apart mentally. One wanted to label them cowards, but then people began to understand this would happen to anybody. So first combat fatigue, same symptoms, but combat fatigue, and then first shell shock. That's what they call it in World War II, World War I, combat fatigue in World War II, and now they call it post-traumatic stress disorder. That's the same thing. Too much exposure, the constant time of being, knowing that any instant you can die, and watching people around you. But combat is just ordinary life speeded up. That's all it is. And at any minute, a nice peaceful situation can turn into a scene of carnage. One godbrother of mine was in an airport in Rome, about to board a plane for Israel, an LL plane, and it was attacked by terrorists at the airport. And he describes it was like 1 minute is a peaceful scene, and some Arab terrorists came up to where people were lined up to get aboard this thing, and they had some hand grenades, and they just, you know, ran them, bowled them along the floor like bowling balls, and all of a sudden, you know, the grenades went off, people opened up with machine gun fire, security guards opened up with machine gun fire, and in the space of just a few seconds, the whole airport had just turned into blood and body parts everywhere, people screaming and crying, just like that. Just a whole peaceful, ordinary scene, Muzak playing, everybody, you know, sitting, eating, laughing, saying goodbye, you know, the happy, and then boom. Scene of utter carnage. It can happen anywhere, anytime. That's the way it is. And that's one of the symptoms of combat fatigue. The sensation that at any minute, that the peaceful features of the material world is an illusion. At any minute, it can go back to what it was in combat. And it's true. See, that's just not enough. You can't say to people who have this realization that you're wrong. They're right. All you can do is just try to hypnotize them into forgetting that they're right. Give them enough Prozac or whatever, and drug them into insensibility. So the point is that because we're spirit souls, actually that position of radical insecurity, of existential mistrust, is not bearable for us. And that's actually because of our spiritual nature. And that's why the people who are actually able to look with a cool eye on life and on death are people like Srila Prabhupada. Because one should not have any investment in the material world. If you have no investment in it, if you've not declared war with material nature, If you have your security based on something else than the course of material nature, then you can look at the world like it is and be sane. So there's resistance to therapy, we should call it. The actual therapy for all our problems in the material world can only begin when people ask this question about themselves. What is the duty of a person who is about to die? What is the most quickest achievement, the best thing to be done for a person who is about to die? Everybody should apply this to themselves with this consciousness that I am on the brink of death, I am standing with one foot on the grave. At any minute, the floor is going to be pulled out from under me, the rug, the floor, the world. And what am I supposed to do? That's the situation. So this is the question. Here we have, at the beginning of Kali Yuga, this question is being asked by the best of questioners, a great devotee, who certainly had on a material basis every possible security that you could ask for. I mean, kings are secure people, especially good kings. They've got palaces, walls, guards, soldiers, money. So the security is there, once they've killed off all their relatives anyway. Anyway, the security is there. Maharaj Pariksit didn't have to do that, but he was in that position on a material basis, but he could understand he was radically insecure. And here's the asking the question. Already, the sages that are gathered are highly qualified. But when Shukadeva Goswami comes, this is the one that the most qualified recognize as the best among them. So now he's receiving the best answer. And you notice that it's not just a theoretical answer, it's practical, because immediately it's put into, the question is a practical question. Because he is on the brink of death, what am I supposed to do? I need to know this answer right away. And so it's also, I have a problem and I need a solution. And when I have a problem, my car is broken, I just don't want to know in theory how it's to be fixed. I need to be fixed. So this is the situation that the practical answer has to be there and put into effect. So not only do we want to know the answer, but he said you want to know the first class method. That's the shuddham. There are different methods, but ultimately we want to know the best remedial method. And as Prabhupada says, the conclusion is devotional service to the Lord Sri Krishna. That should be practiced. And it should be practiced by us with the realization that at any minute it is the time of death. We should be prepared. We should be prepared. So many devotees are putting off their Krishna consciousness until later. Let me get this sense gratification out of my system first. Somehow, when we're thinking like that, we haven't heard Srimad Bhagavatam yet. We haven't listened to what Prabhupada is telling us. This is foolishness. If it helps people to think that, you know, at the year 2000 or whatever, or now, or there's going to be an apocalypse, fine. But if you got to think on a grand Hollywood scale, you just can't die, but there have to be millions before, you know, it perks your interest up, fine. But one should feel that we are not in a state of security. And those people who are thinking there's going to be, you know, some kind of millennial apocalypse, they're all making, you know, survivalist plans, which again is, you know, back on the material level, you know, putting canned peas in the basement and collecting a large arsenal of weapons, you know. I mean, the truth of the apocalypse theory is that the apocalypse is so heavy that there's no material remedy. The apocalypse is one's own death. And apocalypses happen again and again and again. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. Again and again they are destroyed, Krishna says. Again and again they're born. And again wiped out. It's not a unique occurrence. So there should be an urgency that one takes up devotional service to the Lord. So the conclusion arrived at thereof, in Srimad Bhagavatam he says, is that devotional service of the Lord Sri Krishna, as is confirmed by the Lord himself in the last phases of the Bhagavad Gita, is the last word in relation to everyone's permanent duty in life. So he's saying the last phases of the Bhagavad Gita. He means 1866, because here is basically 1866 Sarvadharman Purit Jaja. Did you recognize it in this purport? Huh? The first class method demanded is that one give up all other methods and surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord and thus be saved from all sins and their reactions. That's 1866. Isn't it? That's exactly what Prabhupada is doing. He's paraphrasing that text. If we know the scriptures, we can see in so many cases where Prabhupada, he doesn't say, as it is said in Bhagavad Gita 1866, but you can see what he's paraphrasing. So that's the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. There may be different methods, but give them all up and just become my devotee exclusively, Mam Ekam Saranam Bhaja. And in this way you'll be saved from all sins and their reactions. So here, this is an important verse. He asked this question to all the brahmanas. And as we'll see in the next, very next verse, very dramatically, after placing this question, then Shukadeva Goswami immediately shows up. As though here's the answer. So he asked the questions. Shukadeva Goswami shows up. He's greeted, he sits down. And then Maharaj Parikshit then welcomes him, because now he addresses the same question to Shukadeva Goswami, and that's when the second canto begins with that inquiry to him, and then you'll see it's the same question. So the question is so important that actually it's repeated twice, once to the sages in general, then as soon as he asks it, Shukadeva Goswami comes, and then he, after greeting him, that's the rest of this chapter, then the question comes again. Any questions? Yeah?
Sometimes we see that, like, different people who have been through traumatic experiences, like people who have survived concentration camps or something, or people who have survived, Hiroshima or something like that, and they come out, seemingly well-adjusted. Mm-hmm. I actually did an interview sometimes with these Holocaust survivors, and they were like, one thing about all of them, they're always very successful materially, mm-hmm. and they seem well adjusted. You know, mm-hmm. How, like, when they, see these different things, is that they become, they make some kind of spiritual advancement from seeing that. I mean, they're less good.
I don't know if you can generalize. I really don't know if you can generalize why this happens. People experience these things in a different way. Because you have different grades of people. Some people may make spiritual advancement. Other people may just be able to get apparently forget very successfully. Yeah.
When you talk earlier about the word, that I am a word, and the word is knowledge, and I was wondering, what is this word own, and what is the belief or the
belief? Yeah. Well, the word Om is what's called a bija mantra. Bija means seed. And there are various bija mantras. And sometimes when the Vedic mantras are recited, the Vedic verses are recited, you begin with Om. And it means seed because from the sound, Om, all other sounds are generated. But the Om is a name. It's also a proper name. The absolute truth. It's the same thing as, it means Krishna. It's made up of three sounds. The best way to write it is actually A, U, and M. It designates Krishna, Krishna's energy, Krishna's internal potency. It's been analyzed like that. So it's called this Bija mantra. So if all the Vedic sounds or the words the Vedas were condensed into a seed, just like a seed, there's a whole, there's a little bitty thing, but the whole tree comes out. Well, that seed is A-U-M, Om. Mm-hmm.
I am
the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. Yeah. So that Omkara, the syllable Omkara means to say the syllable Om, is Krishna. Let's say when you say Om, Krishna says you're talking about me. Now Prabhupada mentions someplace when he was asked why we don't chant Om, we chant the Hare Krishna mantra. As he said, the impersonalists have spoiled it. They take the Omkar, even though Krishna says, I am the syllable Om, they take it as an impersonal utterance. So we don't have anything against it, of course, but it's a sacred sound. But unfortunately, it has so many false purports attached to it that that's the problem with it. Okay, it's time to stop now. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.